Hello and welcome to this edition of Life Dunk. It's a slightly different episode. It's just myself and Rabbi Miriam Berger in today, and we're going to talk about some things about getting us into this year's Pesach. So we're doing a Seder supplement of conversation starters. So we've had a difficult few years Seder-wise, although maybe in the long sweep of Jewish history, maybe not so difficult. But certainly, I think the last few years have been particularly difficult. And the last few weeks, I think where we're starting this conversation is difficult, where anti-Semitic attacks are literally very, very close to home. So I think when we talk about this, is it true, Miriam, that we've been, this is so different this year with this fear in us all, or is it just where we've always been?
So I'd love to think that it was different. And I think every year we spend a lot of time thinking it's so different. And we ask the question, why is this night different to all others? And then you take a slightly broader look, and I'm just not sure it is different enough, really. I think we have been here before, and maybe not in our sort of consciousness of Jews in bomb shelters in Israel, no doubt, which is not a political statement, it's a fact. Families divided because of the political reality of why that is, and the difficult conversations around our family tables around Seder and some of the themes. But in my lifetime, I think the themes of Pesach have always been about looking out. Are we truly free when others are not? Kind of vibe, having to look beyond ourselves to think about who can we help and how does our narrative parallel with theirs at this point. And this year, this Pesach, I'm really feeling that there's a question of what does it mean to tell our story in the backdrop of exactly what you say, a backdrop of anti-Semitic attacks far too close to home and war, not just in Israel, but across the Middle East, and the fear of where that's going and what that may look like. There's a quote in the Haggadah, Night to Remember, that we use as a family, by Natan Sharansky, the Soviet refusnik, a prisoner of Siberia, former member of the Knesset. And he just uses this phrase where he says, the idea that a nation of slaves could win its freedom and defeat the most powerful empire in the world was to us not an ancient legend, but an eternal truth. And I think that when we hear those kind of words and we see how easily they reflect on modern day experiences and the backdrop, I think that's one whole piece. And I hope today we'll have some time to talk about Iran and what that looks like. And there's this piece, the five rabbis, who, again, we tend to, and certainly in my Sederim as a child, the five rabbis sitting, discussing, until a student comes into them and says, rabbis, it's time for the morning Shema, has always been, in my world, about, you know, what happens when a Seder goes on too long and everybody's hungry. And it's always been a little bit of a jibe and a tease at the Seder officiant, because it's an ancient text about a Seder going on too long. But actually, the context of it really gives us a very, very different sense of why and what that conversation is. The rabbis are in Bnei Brak, under the shadow of Roman occupation, with a sense of this is just after the Bar Kokhba revolt has failed. And what does it mean to be in a major center of Torah learning, the Golders Green of their time, but during a time of suppression by the Romans? And they were really kind of, it was a Seder under pressure, a Seder where they weren't simply allowed to be themselves. So the fact that they were even having the Seder going on this long was a real commitment of, we're here and we're still alive and we're still doing our Judaism. And that's really important. And yet that final statement of it's time to say the Shema was also that piece of, this isn't just about a cultural narrative of let's have dinner together, Seder. It was a statement of faith. And that concept that they finish their Seder under this shadow of oppression by being able to say the Shema was real, the ultimate refusal to abandon Jewish identity. And perhaps, you know, that's a bit more of how we should be seeing things this year, of that piece that doesn't allow us to hide or retract, but rather to say, this is the time to get into this even more and to really tease out our identity through it.
That's a really interesting story. In one of my Haggadah, I think, it says that that was actually code for the Romans are coming. So that was actually an alarm. That was your early warning thing, which is quite interesting, seeing as, you know, people in Israel really know about having their early warning thing.
So they're, it's the equivalent of their app that says, should I have a shower?
Should go for a shelter now, yeah. Kind of thing. So just go to talk a little bit about the fear. I think that's really interesting about looking out, but I suppose I'm really concerned that fear makes us look in, and it makes it hard for us to look out.
And when you say look out, do you mean for others, as in we should also be thinking of what others are experiencing?
Yeah, absolutely. Your question about it being a liberation story that helps us look out to the world. And I think that when anyone feels beleaguered in any way, but particularly when a community like us at the moment feels so under threat, which isn't just imagined. I think we've sometimes imagined, but it's very clearly not imagined at the moment. Mm. I think it's sometimes hard to be able to have that, I don't know, the generosity or breadth of vision, whatever it is. And how do you think the Seder story or the Haggadah helps us do that?
It's interesting. I was reading something yesterday where somebody was talking about the Nazis thought that what they had to do was oppress us physically and take away our dignity in that way. What Iran and Hamas know is that if they make us feel bad about ourselves, if they make us feel like we are the aggressor or the oppressor, that actually that's the Achilles heel. That's the piece that will turn us in on our side, on ourselves, and an interesting sort of ability to look at our own selves and what makes us turn in and shy away. Can we both look at our own sense of self and our the story as our own liberation story, whilst also seeing it in parallel with we're not the only ones that need liberating? There's a beautiful piece by Primo Levi, the Shoah survivor and novelist, who's written a poem about Pesach. And he ends with a beautiful kind of phrase that is also hits you in that place. He says, each of us has been a slave in Egypt, soaked straw and clay with sweat, and cross the sea dry-footed. You too, stranger, this year in fear and shame, next year in virtue and justice. So perhaps even he, in a different time, is looking at that piece of holding onto both of those needs, to be able to appreciate our own fear and our shame, our critique of lost lives and behaviour, whilst also being able to say, what can we aspire to?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, one of the kind of key stories, isn't it, is the 10 plagues that we talk about. And the last plague, the death of the firstborn, is indiscriminate killing. Cattle, servants, whoever, people. And I think it's a difficult one to have as part of our core text, isn't it?
Definitely. And the 10 plagues has always been something that I have really struggled with and hate the idea of it being used as a narrative that says we've got the superpower God on our side who's able to throw these things at us. But I wonder what happens when we look at that actually as what happens when we're living in a backdrop of society, like one thing after the next, right? Not just blood in the water and lice and cattle disease, but, you know, COVID and war and an NHS on its knees and a cost of living crisis and perhaps a fuel crisis to come. Like, what happens when society says, you've survived this, now what's next, now what's next, now what's next? And how do we use the plagues as that kind of piece that says, actually, for me, the true miracle of the Pesach story is that the Israelites decided, from a perspective of knowing nothing different than slavery, that they could change their lives and the world, right? Like, in actually, in that narrative, Pharaoh is behaving like you'd expect pharaohs to behave, right? That even when we are liberated, even when we have Torah and are being urged to create a just and fair society, we're being told how to look after our slaves, not to have slaves, right? Torah, even in itself, assumes a society that perpetuates that model of some being free and some living in slavery, however much we might be nicer taskmasters than Pharaoh was. And so the idea that what we're celebrating is a narrative of a group of people, our ancestors, who said, we've only known this world, we've only known this existence, and yet we need to be able to rise up, and we need to be able to flee, and we need to be able to create a new life for ourselves, is, I think, the piece which is totally extraordinary to see in the light of what's happening to the Iranian people. That for me, and I think for the Iranians in Finchley who were dancing on our streets only a couple of weeks ago and handing out cakes and celebrating the Iranian flag together with the Israeli flag in the most beautiful way, there was a sense that perhaps these missiles raining down on Iran, perhaps the death of those leaders were the plagues that were going to be enough for society to say, and now it's for us to do what the slaves did. We're at our sea. How do we cross? How do we rise up and say we need to find that change? And the devastating piece for me was seeing it in the Iranian football team. That it, in a way, their ability to stand and not sing the national anthem was their glimmer of, like, we've seen these plagues. We know we can cross this sea. And then it's as if it takes us back to the Exodus narrative, where when the plagues start and Pharaoh's heart is hardened, all that happens is the Israelites' life is made more difficult. Now the straw that was given to them to make the bricks, now they have to collect their own straw, right? Yeah. So you can imagine the slaves would just go, oh gosh, you know, we thought we could do this, but we can't do this. We can't escape. We need to keep going. We need to keep just being the slaves, and maybe they'll give us the straw back. And for me, it was that turning point with the, you know, Iranian population of life has just got harder. You're still having to make the bricks, but now you haven't got the straw. Can you take those next steps forward? And, you know, time will tell. But that's my question, is will they be able to do what we celebrate the Israelites doing?
So that's really fascinating. So I think, if I'm saying it back to you all right, is what you're saying is that what we find in the Pesach story is the ability to dream, to not be, that's the thing. And it's not the actual amazing miracles, which is actually what a lot of the story of the Maggid is about, but it's actually the internal thing of saying we have a vision of a better life. And so my question to you then is, do you think that's why Moses isn't really featured, which is such an interesting thing in the story? Because it's not about a savior, it's about our own internal, finding our own internal strength or freedom of a vision, if that makes sense.
I think so, to some extent. So I think there's a beauty in the structure of the Seder, which takes us from the broken matzah at the beginning to having to reunite those pieces of matzah. So the broken matzah then becomes the afikomen. So you get your bread of affliction at the beginning, which becomes, when you reunite those pieces of matzah with the afikomen, begins that piece into L'shana haba abi Rishalayim, you know, the messianic image of what could be. So you really go from whether it's a personal narrative or a collective societal narrative, from our brokenness to the ability to vision kind of something better and something stronger and something more wonderful. I would suggest that Moses is not in the Haggadah because we all need to find our voice in that Haggadah. We all need to say, there's a place for me in this narrative. It's not about some kind of mythical messianic figure that will do this for us. We can't wait for our own Moses. We may open the door to Elijah, but maybe we're opening the door to our ability to see beyond our own four walls and what we've already got, to be able to say, well, what's my role here? And for me, that's kind of one of my four questions, which would be, you know, what role do I have to play to be able to reunite the brokenness, to heal that brokenness, and to create something better?
So there's the Seder is a fantastic formula, isn't it, about, you know, it's got a fantastic story and it's the most interactive, you know, it's experiential learning as we walk along. Do you think it gives us a blueprint for how we can change things?
I think it gives us some tips. I think it gives us some ideas of how we should go about things. And it has done, I think the Haggadah has done to Seder what the Siddur has done to prayer, right? That in a way, if we never printed our prayers in a Siddur, I think we'd find it easier to pray because we wouldn't be stuck praying somebody else's words. We'd be given some themes and we'd give it our own words, our own language and our own time. And it wouldn't be nearly as alienating for people. And I think the Haggadah has done that same thing to Seder. So actually the Mishnah tells us what we should be doing is eliciting questions, particularly from the children round the table. But what we do is teach our children to recite the Manish Tanath, right? Isn't that beautiful? When we've got our little toddlers being able to ask these questions that we remember from our own childhood. And that's the Lador Vador moment. That's the generation to generation piece. And yet what it breaks down is the ability for a child in their innocence to be able to ask the difficult questions of the adults in society, which I think is really what the Seder is set up to do. How do we tell our story through the lens of what we're experiencing every year? And there's beautiful documents kept from the kibbutzim movement of the 30s and 40s. And part of that is them having collected the questions that were asked by their children at Seidarim at that time. So there's, for instance, kibbutz in Harod in the 1940s, where their children asked the question, why do people all over the world hate Jews? Right? Now, in the backdrop of our kids who have seen only too well in the last 6 months only, from Heaton Park to Bondi, from Michigan to Golders Green, like surely our kids are also asking those questions. But I think we need to be asking the questions of what's going on behind the scenes and how safe are we? That actually is one of our questions as British Jews this year. And I think we need to see the questions in light of the four children, because if we ask that question as the shy child, then we're going to regress into ourselves with fear and allow that fear to hide away from our Judaism. And if we ask that question with the defiance of the other children, then we allow ourselves to say, huh, well, this is our excuse to be able to live a full and proud Jewish life, because nobody's going to kind of hide me away.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I was struck with once was that the word Haggadah, the root of it is opposition. It's not just a story. It's not just telling a sipor. It's not you're not a passive recipient. And if you're really engaging someone, it can be quite oppositional. And those questions are really part of building the narrative, and the way we as Jews build our narrative, which is not just saying this happened, but actually elicits the difficult questions.
Absolutely. And I think that part of that is challenging ourselves to ask how we've always heard the narrative and how we're hearing the narrative differently this year, and how different family members or whoever we're having our Seder with have heard and are hearing that narrative in this year. So, you know, I already questioned, is Pharaoh in the wrong? Was he just behaving as one would expect to? And I think there's a question we should allow ourselves to ask in the Seder, which is, do we see ourselves as victims and or perpetrators of societal norms? And do those societal norms work for us or work for others? And that question of, are there moments, are there some of those societal norms that we see ourselves the victims of or the perpetrators of? We can be on both sides of different societal norms and how they manifest in the world. So there are pieces out there like, well, Jews can't be victims. We know Jews can't be victims because we're all affluent, middle class, white, you know, we fit a particular that says society says we can't be victims. So what happens when we feel oppressed and we can see that we're victims in any moment? What about that question, that piece that is Israel is the aggressor? Is Israel always the aggressor? What does that mean in terms of the societal norms? What are Israelis today facing? They don't feel like the aggressor when they're hiding in their bomb shelters. And when, you know, goodness knows what Seder night will be like for our brothers and sisters in Israel. But then we can look far beyond the Jewish question for those narratives. Women should be mums. Women should look after the house. Women can't be the main breadwinner. What societal norms are affecting ourselves, our marriages, our family life, putting pressure on us in all sorts of different ways? And what about the British narrative? Should Britain take action where our values are not being upheld in the world? Is that a British narrative that we need to wade in when we see things being done wrong? Or should we, you know, pull up the moat and allow ourselves to be on an island?
Pull up the drawbridge.
That's right. You can't pull up the moat. Pull up the drawbridge and allow ourselves to be on an island only looking in. So I think Seder gives us this wonderful opportunity to ask good questions of how we see a story and how we take that on board.
So can I ask you practically then, you know, there's often quite a time pressure, Seder-wise. I don't know about how yours go, if you're not going all night, and people have to go back and some people have work and whatever the next day, or some people are singing in the choir, whatever, leading services. And how practically, what have you done? What ideas have you got this year that you might want to help, you know, make Seder's more interesting, more different, and help people ask those questions in a way that isn't going to lead to family rows, maybe?
I don't think that people should be afraid of the conversation at Seder. I think that people complain that a Seder's too long when they are wittering through, you know, a load of words that they can't connect with. And if you feel you have to recite every word of the Haggadah and go through every page, particularly in Hebrew, if that's not a language that you speak or can connect with or actually understand what you're saying, you're just reading it, there's going to feel like time pressures. But when you're able to take a narrative, a piece that is something you've recited perhaps year after year or resented year after year because you've been a little bit bored, but then you're invited to have a safe conversation, perhaps with the people you feel most comfortable with who may disagree with you. But this is the moment to be able to disagree. I think that the image of the Seder, of starting with the karpas, was not just meant to be a little stem of parsley and then a long wait until a meal. It was telling us, this is giving you the ability to graze. This is saying, this is not a time to get hungry. The meal will come, but you can nosh throughout. There should be snacks on the table. And I think a well-crafted Seder is one where somebody has really looked at, okay, this is the list, right? This is the Seder. This is what we have to get through. So some of them are just a 30-second thing. Dip the parsley in the salt water and say a blessing. But what are the moments we're going to dwell on a little bit more to be able to open up this conversation, which is how do we tell our story in the light of what it means to be sitting as Jews around a table this year?
So really, really practically, some people are really comfortable and some people are less comfortable. For the people who are less comfortable about knowing how, like the order, that what would you say in to help people plan a more interesting Seder, what they could do this year?
I would say every Haggadah essentially has an index page. And the index is seen as part of the liturgy. It's not actually the index that you might assume right at the beginning. But the index are the Simanei HaSeder, the signposts for the Seder. And what it gives us are 15 steps of the Seder. Everything else is commentary, right?
Right.
Those are the 15 steps that you have to go through. The first cup of wine for Kiddush, the washing of the hands, the dipping the karpas, the breaking the matzah, the telling the story, washing the hands again, the blessing over the matzah. You know, those are the things that you get, those 15 steps. And I would say starting from them and opening those up to say, okay, what do those mean to us? Rather than opening the whole Haggadah and saying, okay, how do we get through all of this liturgy, would be the simplest way of arranging your Seder and making it not too long, but also meaningful. What do each of these steps mean to you?
That's lovely. I like that. So one of the things is, well, I suppose it's about, we've been talking about is fear and how we take control of the Seder and how we can take control of our world. And Wellspring is about taking control to some extent. It thinks about, well, you should ask you really, Wellspring is about how we take control of our lives. And are there elements of the Seder which encourage us to see life through a Wellspring lens?
Absolutely. I think that everything within this story can be looked at both from a personal narrative as well as a collective narrative. Even from the moment, the night before Seder, when we're doing Bedikat Chametz, the search of the Chametz, the search for the crumbs, there's a question which is, what are those things that we need to be sweeping out of our lives this year? What do we need liberating from? What are the things that actually cause us to feel that sense of the yachatz, the kind of the brokenness that we start our Seder with? And I think for many of us, we hold onto those things as simply part of our lives, who we are. This is just an accepted part of these are the burdens I have to carry. But actually what the Seder is teaching us is there are those glimmers, right? There are the ways that we see the potential for the future. We see the glimmers of spring, even when, you know, there is no sign of hope. And I think each of us is given that opportunity to say, what would our liberation look like? And there's not many Israelites, I suspect, who would have left Egypt if they'd have known they were about to spend 40 years in the wilderness, right? we sometimes stay in the most negative situations because not only can we not see the fantasy, the perfect piece at the end, but it's the piece before that that really scares us. You know, people who are in loveless marriage, the number of people who've said, we just can't really afford to get divorced, or it isn't fair on the children, or I have to wait until. And, you know, I would ask that question if that's where they're thinking, if that's the piece that feels like they're being enslaved by, is it worth staying because you're scared of the wilderness years, when actually what comes after the wilderness years may be the liberation that you're looking for? And so I think for me and for Wellspring, Pesach is that opportunity to ask the question of what enslaves us, and perhaps give ourselves not an immediate, not to think that therefore tomorrow everything will be changed, but perhaps look to Rosh Hashanah, look to 6 months from now and say, how do I have wanted to have taken control of my life a bit differently? That by the time I get to Rosh Hashanah, perhaps things will be a bit different.
Yeah, and I think that's beautiful. It reminds me of that gorgeous bit by Lionel Blue where he says about why we might not hear God talking to us. And one of the things is God might take us into the wilderness and we might wander there for 40 years, and that's pretty scary. I rather like also the idea that the whole story really starts with women being quietly revolutionary, and the two midwives, Shifra and Pua, kind of saying, we value human life that much. I also love that we don't know whether they're Israelites or Egyptians as well, but they just said, we see the human in the other.
And what those names, you know, do for us, whether it's them or whether it's Miriam or whether it's Yocheved, like the characters in the early part of the Pesach story don't change the world. They change one life, or simply their own lives, right? So Shifra and Pua, we think of as being, you know, these revolutionaries. We know they change the world, but only within their very small remit of being midwives. Miriam plays the part of simply being the protective big sister. Even Pharaoh's daughter simply sees one baby in need and takes them in. And I think so often when we're thinking about the world, it feels big and unimaginably impossible to change very much from our tiny perspectives. And actually, one act of kindness can be revolutionary. You know, one change of attitude to one person has a knock-on effect. That's what this story teaches us. So I think if we tried to be a little bit more Shifra, Pua, Miriam, Yocheved, and worried less about being Moses, perhaps we'd all change the world.
And do you think that's significant that that's women?
I think it's often how either women are remembered, or how women quietly behind the scenes get on, right? Would the world be different if we didn't have the men of Netanyahu and Trump and Putin and, you know, all of these big male characters who are very sure that they are right and very sure that they know how to create change in a global way? I suspect there's something of the gender divide in how we see the world.
There's a gorgeous midrash that Aviva Zornberg talks about, that when they were so oppressed, the Israelite men as slaves felt so awful about themselves that they didn't even want to have sex because they felt so diminished. And so the women got together and they decided that the men would come in from having built the pyramids, whatever, made the bricks. And the women were standing in front of mirrors going, aren't I beautiful? Look at me, aren't I gorgeous? And kind of just remembered them, reminding the men to be men and to be their husbands and you know, and to have the children. And to
right.
Have, you know.
And again, you know, quietly revolutionary, yeah. Right? Like if our future is being oppressed and we're thinking, why would we bring more children into the world if our boys are being killed? And actually there's something about, no, we have to keep having these babies. We have to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely.
So again, just that sense of the tougher life is, the more we say, I'm just going to keep living and keep doing and keep having fun.
So just before we kind of end, there's one song that pretty much everyone knows the at least the chorus to, which is Dainu, and sings along to. It's a sort of interesting song where it sort of gets more and more. And we can talk about the song, or maybe we could just talk about where we are now. There's obviously that great joke at the moment circulating, which is about how terrible things are. You know, the one about there's a terrible anti-Semitism at Harvard and the students having a terrible time, and the person coming, whoever it is, your great-grandfather goes, "What, there's Jews at Harvard?" And you're saying, "Yeah, no, yes, I know, but honestly, that's awful." And actually, you know, do you know the joke? There's the academics have, so the Jewish academics having time, "What, their Jews have become professors at Harvard? That's incredible." Yeah, and yes, they have become professors, but the ones from Israel having a terrible time, that, what do you mean from Israel? Well, you know, the Jewish homeland. Oh, you mean there's a Jewish homeland, and maybe you don't have it quite so bad. But is this the best we can hope for? What are this fear? We are living through a pretty difficult time. So there's great things that we can't ignore, but there's also really difficult things.
I wonder if it's woven into our DNA to say, not Dayenu, it's enough, but actually this isn't enough. You know, already the Israelites, as soon as they've fled from Egypt, are complaining about the food in the wilderness and saying, what's this manna we've got to eat? You know, the food was better in Egypt. And so I wonder if the thing that gives us that urge and that drive and the survival is partly the ability to say, we might sing it and sing, you know, Dayenu, it would have been plenty, it would have been enough, but always to actually hold on to the fact that it's not enough. Our Afghani Jewish brothers and sisters gave us a wonderful way of looking at Dayenu. They gifted us the minhag, the tradition of whipping those around the Seder table with us with the spring onions during that song Dayenu. Their way of saying, actually, this is not enough. We may be singing Dayenu, it would have been enough, but actually we're still feeling that oppression. And for me, it's a wonderful way of holding onto that Jewish narrative that is the very thing in our family Seder that says, this is still really tough, and this is still not the backdrop that we want it to be. And we've gone from COVID Seders to hostages in Gaza Seders to anti-Semitism and war Seder. This is tough. We're still feeling the whipping of the ancient world. And yet this is the thing that brings such joy and such hilarity into my Seder that actually there's a piece that says, and it's that very same thing that gives us what we pass on through generation to generation, a pride and a love of our Judaism, which is the essence of what all of this is. It's about saying we are an important chain in this link of tradition, and it takes us all the way back, and we're not going to be the reason that it falls apart.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. Any other wishes for Pesach, things to come?
I mean, you know, it's hard not to let go of that desire, that wish of Lashana Haba'a B'Yerushalayim. What does it mean to say next year in Jerusalem? And I mean that in both a literal way of being able to say an Israel in peace and a world that encapsulates all our values and is able to not be in peace at the expense of others, but truly in peace with the world around us, where everybody can flourish, and to be able to take Primo Levi's words and to be able to say next year in virtue and justice.
Thank you very much, Miriam.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.